talk to me, if you will, Rob, about your kind of journey to Florida. How, why, how it happened.
Well, you know, I'd worked at the NPR station at Antioch, which is WYSO, which served Dayton and the surrounding communities like Xenia and Springfield. And WYSO always viewed itself as kind of a hybrid between an NPR station and a community station. And a lot of people from WYSO, the old radio station where I worked at, went on to work at NPR stations and to community radio stations around the country.
Oh, yeah.
I was from Pennsylvania originally, and Antioch was in Ohio. I went back home after I graduated in 77 and worked. I had two jobs. I was working at a college campus as an AV guy, and I was working with inner city kids. And I really wanted to do radio. So I saw an ad in Muck Jones magazine in the winter of 1977 that said, "We're starting a community radio station in Tampa. Would you like to come down?"
And Muck Jones. Wow.
Yeah.
Haven't heard that name in a long time.
Yeah. So I'd been to Tampa once and I liked it. And it, I think I applied during a huge snowstorm, and snow was falling around me in Pennsylvania, and I wanted to get out of there. And so I applied for the job, and a guy named Joe Fox hired me and hired me to come down to Tampa. And so I made my way down in June of 1978.
And community radio to me in those days was particular. It seems to me, I'm 62, but it seems to me that there was a sort of a, you know, Mother Jones Firefox sort of era backlash against commercial radio, like let's take back the airwaves kind of thing, because it was getting pretty commercial. Is that kind of the thing that appealed to you?
Yeah, that was it exactly.
Yeah.
At WYSO, I was introduced to jazz and blues, and I was introduced to New Orleans music, and I heard bluegrass for the first time, and really hard-hitting, serious public affairs and news shows. And back home in Pennsylvania, it was all commercial radio. There was one public radio station, but it was pretty bland. It was all classical music, and I knew that radio could be so much more than just, than just commercial top 40 and classical music. So and I knew that Tampa didn't really have much. The story in Tampa was that for a while we had Underground Railroad on the air in 1973, 74, and 75.
Oh, USF. Oh, sure, I remember that. Yeah.
USF. It was student-run, and it was student-run because the students paid an activities fee that helped support WUSF radio. But in 1975, the then president of USF, Cecil Mackey, took all the rock and roll off WUSF and put it on Friday and Saturday nights at 11 o'clock for 2 hours, and it filled the station with classical music. NPR didn't really get into talk shows until more than a decade later. So what USF sounded like back then was classical music with jazz starting late at night.
Yeah.
And then they had one hour program. It was called All Things Considered.
Yeah.
And All Things Considered had not yet evolved into a 2 hour show, and it started every day at 5 o'clock, and by 6 o'clock it was off USF. So there really wasn't much for students to listen to. I mean,
yeah.
Maybe the rock on Friday and Saturday night, and maybe the jazz overnight, but there wasn't much. So we knew that there was a big potential in Tampa if we were to start a radio station that had bluegrass, that had big band, that had jazz in the daytime, that had rock and roll, alternative rock and roll, not just top 40.
Yeah.
And reggae and all the music styles that were seeking a place on commercial radio, and commercial radio was rejecting all those music styles at the time in 78.
I remember only too well, my friend, only too well. I was born and raised here in St. Pete. So was it, I mean, you say I wanted to be in radio. I mean, were you ever, was music ever it for you? Was it always news and public affairs for you? I mean, that's the direction you wanted to go because you have a degree in journalism.
Yeah, well, I start off at WYSO just handing records to my friend Jeff Rubin, who did a rock and roll show on WYSO. And
a noble occupation, handing records, yeah.
Yeah, just, mm-hmm. He said, He said, give me that one, and yes. I would unsleeve it and hand it to him delicately, and then he put it on the turntable. So I did a little bit of music at Wiso, not much.
Yeah.
But I love music, and I had a huge collection. I was a jazz freak. I love blues. I love bluegrass. I love rock and roll, and so that was my main collection. I drove down in 1975 with about 500 albums, which is a lot of albums.
Yeah.
And I love both news and music.
Well, at M&F, when it was like, okay, I'm doing this, what did they hire you as? Was it always as a news guy, as the new, or
no? I was the first program director. So
wow.
So when it came to putting on everything that we started with, jazz, blues, reggae, new wave, bluegrass, all the music styles that we played, the 60s rock and roll show, the folk shows, yeah. I selected all the early programmers. And in fact, some of those programmers are still around, the ones that I selected way back in 79 when
wow.
we went here. So I knew music, and I think we hit the ground running. I mean, we probably, when we started, we were 100% music, and then in the first year we added some news, we added some comedy shows, and eventually by 1985 we had the women's show was mostly public affairs. That was on for 2 hours Saturday morning, and then we had a public affairs show on Tuesday nights at 7 o'clock.
Yeah.
And we had public affairs at 1 o'clock every day, and then we had the Pacifica News combined with our own news at 4:30. So we were by 85 we were doing maybe 10 or 15 hours a week of, well, 10 hours a week of public affairs and news.
You were on the air yourself, right? Were you on the air?
Yeah. So we had a morning newscast at 7:45 and 8:45. So I did most of those newscasts. I did the 1 o'clock public affairs show, and then I found the initial women's show hosts, but the collective would always decide what the women's show was going to sound like that week. And a lot of women went through that program and learned radio. This is back in the late 70s, early 80s.
Were you surprised, I have to ask you, that M&F, we'll say has lasted as long as it has. I mean, that surprised you? I mean, was there a thought that, yeah, we'll get a good 10-year run out of this?
No, because when I worked at WISO, one of my projects for my journalism class was to go around Dayton and ask people what their favorite radio stations were and kind of write a report about why people listen to radio and what they listen to. And what I found was that a lot of people in Dayton listened to WISO. I mean, there was a really good progressive radio station on the University of Dayton campus, and they would go as far as to play Joni Mitchell and Randy Newman,
yeah.
along the kind of standard rock and roll at the time. But I knew Wiso was onto something, because we had these great jazz shows. We had bluegrass every morning, and we had a great guy doing blues, Chicago blues. I think he was on Tuesday nights. I can't remember. And mm-hmm. Anyway, I knew that we were onto something based on what Wiso was doing in the Dayton area. So when I came down to Tampa, and I knew that there was a gap, I knew it was going to be successful from the start. And when we did our first fund drive, which I think was in the spring of 1980, pretty sure that's when it was, we immediately had 2,000 people donate. I mean, we went door to door. When I first got down here, the project had no money.
Yeah.
So I came down in June of 1978. And Joe Fox, who hired me, said, okay, now you got to go door to door to raise money to build the radio station. And I went into that old house at 305 South Boulevard in Hyde Park, and there was nothing in that house. There was no radio equipment, no microphones, no turntables. We had no transmitter. We had no antenna. And so we had to do it all ourselves. And there were no grants available for, at least at that point. And
okay.
So it...
Yeah.
My 500 album collection was measly compared to what we eventually ended up by by September of 1979. We had thousands of records that we want, and they would send us so much stuff. They would send us crap that we were never going to play, and they would send the good stuff too. And so we had thousands of records in that small record library right off the sunroom at 305 South Boulevard by the time we went on the air. We had even planned to do a classical show, so we even had a classical selection, even though USF was doing really a great job of classical music at the time.
I guess what I meant was it lasted so long that community support. I don't know the total and complete history of MNF, but it seems to me that the community never sort of flagged in its support that being here this long, that's kind of an amazing success story too.
It is, and you know, keep me on track because sometimes I'll go off track. But yeah, if you look at any community our size, Cincinnati, Atlanta, Dallas, Miami, that also have community radio stations that are about as old as WMNF. We are we are far, 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 far above. We're far more successful than any of those cities with comparable community radio stations that started about our time. But we're doing so much better, and we're doing better than I think financially. Than most of the stations in the big cities like WBAI in New York, we're doing better financially than they are. And I'm saying it currently, but you know,
yeah,
I mean, I still feel kind of part of the station, but
hey, man, so you helped build the station. I mean, come on.
So am I surprised? I knew we were onto something, and the thing that kept us, I think, the thing that kept us honest over the years was that we had this really strong community connection. So if we, you know, we knew that the blues show on Friday night was fabulously supported. We knew that our bluegrass shows were fabulously supported, and our 60s rock and roll show was fabulously supported. Usually what happened, though, is that over time, just some of those hosts or some of the music would get stale, and you could tell because the number of donations would drop.
Right.
And then what we would do is we might change the host, or we might change the hour of the show, or we might cancel the show entirely. But we always had our ear to the ground to figure out what was working, and plus we put on all these concerts. So we put on maybe 1,000 concerts over the past 43 years.
Yeah.
And you could tell when you brought an artist to town, name your artist. We brought Lucinda Williams to town.
I was going to say like Steve Earle or somebody like that. Yeah.
Yeah, Steve Earle. Yeah. Somebody. And you would pack the place, and you knew, okay, this is an important artist, and we got to keep playing her and bringing her back if we can afford her. You know.
Yeah.
Lucinda. So we always kept a really strong ear to the ground and a connection to that community. And we would pay attention to, for a long time, we paid attention to what songs were getting requested. And so we looked at marathon results, we looked at song requests, we looked at concert turnout, we looked at even in the last, you know, 10 or 15 years, we looked at emails, what songs are getting good response to the emails. So we really tried to keep that strong community connection. Same thing for our public affairs.
Yeah.
If we did an interview or played a speech or did a topic that really connected with the listeners, we would do that topic more just because listeners were responding in a positive way to it. And that it was that keeping that ear to the ground and knowing what our listeners were demanding that kept us honest too, because we weren't putting something on the air just because we thought it was good and we're going to force it down people's throats. Mm-hmm. We would try it. And if it worked, we kept doing it. And then if it didn't work, we'd try something else.
Let's talk about the Craig Kopp incident. And, I mean, is that something you saw coming? Did you start to feel like an anachronism at MNF? Or were you surprised at that?
Well, the reason I got fired by Craig Kopp was that we had done a music cruise, and but we were charging a lot of money for it. We were charging like I think $500 a ticket or so, $100 a ticket per person. And the bands were absolutely the best some of the best bands that M&F could attract, and it was a really good, when it came to entertainment, it was really good.
Yeah.
But from the time that we came up with the idea of the cruise, perhaps in the early fall of that year, to the time that the cruise happened in the winter of that year, we aired more than a thousand announcements on M&F,
right,
practically begging people to buy the $500 ticket.
You got, well, you know, there's a lot of money involved in it.
Yeah, a lot of money hiring the artist. Well, in the end, we only sold about 200 tickets. So if you were to tune into M&F at any point during that 3 or 4 month period before the cruise, you not only heard what was essentially an advertisement for the cruise, but you also heard people talking about what it's like on a cruise. What do you do on a cruise? You know, how much do you have to bring to pay for food? How much should you bring to pay for liquor and all that?
Let me guess. Your hackles got up.
Well, we're not there to cater to people that have $500 so they can go on a 3-day cruise. That wasn't the idea of M&F. The idea of M&F, really, when we started, was to broadcast to low and moderate income people. That was one of the mainstays. One of the reasons all of us were hired. All the early people were hired because we wanted a public radio station that was not elitist. And the other thing about cruises is that per capita. It contributes more to global warming, 100% more to global warming when you're on a cruise than when you're just living your life the way you do. Plus, cruise ships are notoriously polluters. And that never came up in the discussion as we were planning this. You know, I would raise it a little bit. And between the overkill on announcements, the pollution caused by the cruise, and the elitism of the $500 or $600 ticket, one of my friends on the morning show asked me after the cruise, and I was doing the news. They asked me, "Well, what'd you think of the cruise?" And I thought, I said on the air, and I probably shouldn't have said this, it was the dumbest thing we've ever done.
Wow!
Because it was elitist. We couldn't sell tickets if we gave them away. We only sold 200 tickets, And we were contributing to ocean pollution and carbon dioxide pollution. And I thought that really isn't in the spirit of what we just, we wanted a radio station that would not harm the environment. And we wanted a radio station that wouldn't contribute to pollution, that wouldn't contribute to elitism. And so I said it on the air. Craig fired me for that. Hmm. And I think from Craig's perspective, I understand. You don't want to say anything negative about your radio station. Craig is an old school commercial radio guy, and that was the way he was brought up. And he thought, well, okay, I've got a host on the air, I've got a paid staffer on the air, who said bad things about the cruise, and you can't have that. But I don't think that Craig came from the kind of background that we all came from, where, you know, the values of the environment, the values of non-elitism, were important to him. I think he came from a commercial radio background where you got to zip your lips and not say anything bad about the organization that you work for.
And you got to sell the sponsor's product, right? You know.
Yeah, and so, you know, it's two different views of radio. Either the values are most important, or loyalty to the boss is important. And I think Craig thought, well, loyalty to the boss is the most important thing. So that's why I got fired. But then when I got fired, immediately there was a practically a revolution, because hundreds of people canceled their memberships in the station, and then thousands of people signed a petition to get me rehired. So the story was never really fleshed out that much in the print explanations, but that was the story behind why I got fired that time.
Well, now I'm happy to tell people that. Let's go up to Mr. Fernandez and talk about you know, what's happened in, what was it, April of this year. What do you want to say about it?
Well, I mean, I'll just say that my firing this time, I was not given a very deep explanation for my firing this time. But what I do know is that in January of this year, I got an email into the air studio from a listener who said, this is around January 6th, who said, the Proud Boys don't really present much of a threat to American democracy. And the person wrote something to the effect that there were only six Proud Boys or a few Proud Boys in Washington, D.C., and that they weren't going to harm our democracy. And I wrote him back and I said, essentially, our democracy is at peril. And, you know, I take this very seriously. And I had done a bunch of programs about the danger of the rise of right-wing groups in the U.S. So just the week before, I aired a documentary about the rise of fascism in Europe. I made the connection between the kinds of big lies that are being told in the U.S. today to the kind of big lies that were told in Germany in the 1940s and 30s. And I said, this is a very dangerous time, and we've got to take it seriously. So this person and I had an email exchange, and finally I got kind of exasperated, and I said, essentially, well, you're siding with the fascists. And I said it in slightly stronger words, but that's what I said to him, and this happened in January. Well, Rick, the manager, knew about it at the time because the guy who I wrote to, and this is just an email, wasn't on the air. Rick knew about it at the time, and he had a conversation with me, and he said in January, he said, well, don't write to this guy, don't email this guy again. And I said, okay, I won't.
Right.
And then 3 months later, on April 9th, on a Friday afternoon, he calls me into his office and he fires me over the incident that happened in January. The only thing Rick said at the time in January was, don't write this guy again. And then in April, he said, well, I'm firing you over this January incident.
He hadn't had any further communication with this listener at all, as far as you know. I'm still really steamed about what Rob Lori said. You know, or not, that's like 4 months.
Yeah, it's 3 months or 4 months.
Yeah, whatever something. It is. Yeah, yeah.
Whatever it is. Yeah. I didn't have any other communication with the listener, and I agreed with what Rick said. I shouldn't email the guy back. But I don't know. You know. I don't know anything beyond that. I don't know what kind of conversation Rick had with this listener or what went on. But Rick waited several months before he fired me and didn't write me up or didn't write anything in my file. I don't think there's anything in my file, but I think in a typical job, somebody might, if what the employee did was really serious, they might be either fired on the spot in January, or they might be written up and reprimanded in a written reprimand.
So that was a total surprise to you in April on Friday. Hey, you're out of here after so many years. What did that feel like? I mean, if I may ask.
43 years?
Yeah.
How did I? Well, I felt it was a serious serious injustice. And I thought that Rick, the manager, didn't get the seriousness of what the country's up against. We always stood up to fascism, and we always stood up to racism. So when he fired me over this, I thought he wasn't taking the prospect of fascist takeover seriously. Well, it's because Rick is from, he has a different view of life, and I'm not saying he's pro-fascist. I'm just saying that he doesn't understand the danger the country is in right now. And so what he's also done is he's cut public affairs on the station.
Yeah.
Well, the public affairs, most of that public affairs, especially when I was on, stood up to fascism and stood up to the right-wing excess. You know, I'm not talking about Republicans. I'm talking about people that really think that it's their right to interfere with the election certification. I mean, that's totally against the Constitution.
Can you see, let me ask this way, like someone like his, like Rick's perspective on, you're a reporter. You know, I mean, I face this a lot over the years. You're a reporter, keep your opinions out of it, and maybe not understanding that that was what MNF was built on.
Yeah, MNF always had opinionated people and opinionated reporters. So,
sure.
I mean, we took a stand. In our mission statement, it says that we're there to promote equality and peace and social justice. And when, let's say, fascists believe that they're more equal than any other group in the U.S., that they have a right to storm the Capitol, whereas nobody else has the right to storm the Capitol. I mean, that the core of MNF has been to stand up to those kind of groups. People always asked us in the early days, they said, well, you're a community radio station. Are you like public access? And we said, no, public access accepts all comers. We will not allow people who are racist or sexist or homophobic to be on the air, because that's where we stand on the issues. So we always had that point of view, and our reporters always had that point of view.
Uh-huh.
And our public affairs people had that point of view. That was what we required of people that did news and public affairs. So there was a slant, but I think we thought, and I still do think, it's an honorable slant to be in favor of those values. And we publicize those values. We've always, we used to read the mission statement on the air almost every day, but it was published in our program guide. It's always published in our program schedule. It's on our website. So that's always what we believed. And I think with Rick not having having the same concerns, the historic concerns that those of us that went through the civil rights movement in Vietnam and went through some of the other struggles over the last 50 years, Rick didn't go through a lot of that. So he doesn't know how dangerous these times are. But there needs to be a station that stands up to it. You've got commercial stations here in town that promote this belief that the election was stolen and promote the big lie and are cheering on the insurrectionists. There needs to be one station that says forthrightly, no, not on our watch.
Did you have any interest or intention in fighting this? I mean, you haven't gone public with this story until now. I mean, you weren't going to go down fighting the first time. Why did you do it this time?
Well, I always intended to retire in about 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't, the way to fight this is to file a lawsuit against the station. But here's a station that I helped build. And we went from a budget of $0 to $1.7 billion. And I'm not about to file a lawsuit or hurt the station. I want the station to continue because I think that we're entering some dangerous times. I think Rick thinks the station should be about music, and I think that's what his main focus is. And I think the station needs to be more than just music. But I also think that, I was fired once, and because of the good wishes of thousands of people, I was rehired. I think a lot of people would say, well, if the guy's fired twice, there must be something wrong with the guy. And so I've decided not to fight it. Because I don't want to be that cranky person that tries to get his job back. I was 2 years away from retirement. I still have, you know, people have come up to me with a lot of ideas, and some of the ideas are working out about what I should do next. I'm not retired, but I just don't want to put the station through, you know, a lawsuit and that kind of struggle. I think the station, you know, I hope eventually the station regains its footing and stands for, you know, begins to put on programs to challenge the Proud Boys. There are a few people on the station that still do that, but there's a lot less of that kind of programming than before when I was there.